Hey everyone, I'm Brad, and this is Beyond the Big Red Truck Podcast. Welcome to episode 3. Yep, we made it. Episode 3. Or should I say epic-sode 3. This is going to be awesome. Had a great conversation today with a good friend of mine, Eric Bjarnason. He is a 29-year firefighter and officer with North Van City Fire Department. He is a member of North Shore Rescue for the past 30 years, since January of 1988, volunteering his time to help others. He is a member of the Florian's Knights Motorcycle Club. And the Florian's Knights, their mission is to strengthen the bond between firefighter brothers whose passion is to ride Harley-Davidsons for a greater cause and to provide for the communities in which they serve. They support and help the brothers, active or retired, with mental health issues. Firefighting as a career is a way of life, as it is a riding club. So that's just what the Florian's Knights are. We'll talk a little bit more about that later. They do some great charity work. They do fundraising. And their clubhouse, which I found out today, is just a place that, you know, any firefighter can go and receive some support from people who have been through what they've been through. It's a safe place. The Florian's Knights raise money for the Burn Fund, BC Professional Firefighters Burn Fund, and the resiliency program that's put on by, as well, the BC Professional Firefighters. And Eric is a team lead at that same resiliency program. So he goes back on his own time, spends 4 days a month being a resource for the firefighters who are struggling and need help with some mental health and maybe would rather talk to someone who's been through some of the stuff instead of one of the psychologists. So he's a great dude. He's a mountaineer. First and foremost, one of the quotes that, and I speak of it in the podcast, but you know, Eric says, "For me, mountaineering was one of the major things that defined me as a person." And you'll see that. He's written a book about his experiences. He's climbed some of the highest mountains in the world, including Everest and Mount Logan in the Yukon, which is where his story kind of begins. And it's a story of how they got caught in a subtropical cyclone, which is something that is kind of an unexplainable, something that, you know, Mother Nature just decides that it's going to happen right now, and it happens. And there's nothing they could have done about it. They were prepared. They've been climbing for years. And this is Eric's story about how he and his crew got caught in that storm, in that cyclone, and how Eric got frostbite so bad that he lost most of his fingers and one thumb. It's a story about his survival, his near-death experience, his healing, his mental healing, his physical healing, and what he's doing now and the changes he's made in his life based on those experiences that he's had. So it's a great conversation. Please stick around. I love this guy. He is awesome. And what he's doing, despite his experience on Mount Logan, he is a fighter. He does not take no for an answer. and he is very inspiring. So please listen, and we'll see you on the other side. Enjoy. Eric, how you doing, buddy?
Doing great.
Yeah? It's a little wet out here today. And so where are we right now? I've just showed up at your address here, and we're...
We're at the clubhouse of the Florian Knights.
Yeah.
On Parker Street in Burnaby, which is a motorcycle club made up of entirely firefighters. And thank God for this rainy weather, or we'd all be out riding today.
And then we wouldn't be able to sit down and talk. Yeah, this is an awesome place. And we'll talk about it later on.
Sure.
when we kind of see what how this flows here. But so we're going to talk a little bit about, or hopefully you're going to talk to me and us about your experience on Mount Logan and your book Surviving Logan, and just kind of a little bit of history about yourself and how you got maybe to be a firefighter, and your history with, because I know a lot of that stuff already, but your history with North Shore Rescue and the city of North Van fire, and then kind of take us into Logan and that kind of stuff. So
I followed the family line. My uncle was a firefighter and a member of North Shore Search and Rescue, so I grew up listening to the stories and decided quite young that I was going to do both. And luckily for me, I was able to achieve both goals. So I got hired by North Shore Rescue and North Van City Fire Department in 89. And the rescue team, what a great bunch of guys, because they're all like-minded men and women. And every year somebody would plan a trip and they would just see who was available. So it turned out to be a small group of us that every year we'd go somewhere and climb. Usually down South America, did a lot through Asia. And in May of 2005, we decided for the 40th anniversary of North Shore Rescue, we were going to climb Mount Logan, which is the highest, coldest mountain in Canada, second highest in North America after Mount McKinley. But it's much more remote and a little bit more difficult to climb, so nobody climbs it. Like, there's maybe, 20, 30 people a year instead of, the hundreds on McKinley. So it's very, very private climb. It's a it's a climb like I always dreamed climbing would be, when you're on the mountain by yourself. And you may run into another party once in a blue moon.
Right.
And it was a...
Sorry, buddy.
Oh, no, I was going to say it was a beautiful, beautiful climb. We had already made it to the high as we were going to go, and we're on our way down. And we got hit by a subtropical cyclone, which is super rare. And we just happened to be at the worst possible place when the storm hit.
Right. And before you guys, just to back up a little bit, before you guys left... you have experienced climbers, you got, yourself, I know just from reading your book, but you've been on numerous climbs, numerous heights, numerous places in the world. And, so this was kind of sounded like it was just kind of maybe the next step for you to, why not try and, or not try, but why not climb the Canada's tallest peak for the 40th anniversary?
Well, the team that I went with, I would climb anything with them. They're the best, I think, in the world, because they're highly trained and their only motivation is to have a good time. They're not summit baggers, so they're not going to step over a body to get to the top like right. happens in Everest. They only want to do a safe, fun climb.
Right.
And that's exactly what we did. We just happened to be told by Mother Nature, like, nope, this isn't your turn.
Right. Yeah, so... And yeah, so you mentioned the subtropical cyclone.
Yeah.
Is that what you called it?
Yeah, so I didn't even kind know of
they what, yeah, what do you know? Can you explain that a little bit? Like, just so people kind of understand a little bit about.
I still don't quite understand what it is.
Oh, okay.
It was such a huge storm that a couple meteorologists did studies of it, and they've actually written reports on it because it's such an unusual thing.
Right.
And we happened to be on a knife ridge when it hit us. So we had about, 1500 foot drop on one side and a couple thousand foot drop on the other. And we just couldn't move. It pinned us to the ground. We were able to get ice screws in. We were able to get a tent up, luckily, but the winds were so powerful. It just blew everything apart, blew the tent apart, blew our gear away. It, just created an an atmosphere that was just unlivable. So the only thing we could actually manage to do was dig a big hole in the ground and lay in it like a grave for about 2.5 days without food or water and about negative 90 with the wind chill.
Wow. So, and maybe just if you could explain the type of gear that you had, just like your personal, like in firefighting, we got our PPE, personal protective, like what kind of gear did you have? And then I know that you lost some of your gear and you lent out your some of your gloves and that kind of thing. So maybe just explain that a little bit on, cause that's crazy too. And then your friends, you were with two other people and they went and tried to build another grave or whatever you guys call it there. But, and then they kind of left you and just kind of that part, and what you were feeling there and how it affected.
Well, sure. When you climb, it's all about layering. So against our skin, we wear what's called a wick away, which pulls moisture away from the body, and then fleece, and then Gore-Tex and heavy Gore-Tex and then down.
Yeah.
So you're looking at layers upon layers, and I wear 5 sets of gloves. And one of the pairs of gloves, one of the girls who joined our group later, she wasn't a North Shore Rescue Team member, lost her glove. So I was heading down. She was heading up with another guy that I knew. And I offered to lend her my glove, which was a mistake. I shouldn't have done that, but I made that mistake. So when we were able to get the tent up, when the storm hit, it was getting so bad that we knew the tent was going to be blown apart. Right. So my buddies Alex and Don decided they're going to go build a snow cave and I'm going to melt some ice and make some water. So I took 3 sets of my biggest mitts off after I got everything ready. So I have my bucket of snow beside me. I've primed the stove. I have everything. All I have to do is light the stove. So I took the 3 sets of the biggest gloves off, put them on my lap for a fraction of a second. And all I'm going to do is light the stove and then put my gloves back on. This was just as Alex and Don were getting out of the tent. So Alex was out of the tent. Don was half in the tent, half out of the tent. So the zipper was actually open. And now instead of having all of our weight of like 600-700 pounds in the tent, now there's only me. And that's when a rogue gust of wind came, hit the tent, broke it free of the anchors, and I was up in the air. And I was just tumbling towards the cliff. And luckily, like I said, because the tent zipper was open, when I was in the air, it dumped all the gear that was left in the tent out, and I happened to be with that gear. So when I got dumped out of the tent, Dawn looked down at me and goes, "Eric, where are your gloves?" And right away, in that fraction of a second, I made a terrible mistake. When you climb, everything is attached to you or secured, and I did not secure the gloves. So when the tent got blown away, my biggest sets of mitts got blown away with it. So my hands started to freeze immediately. So I was basically the weak link in the chain now. So I was useless. So they go to me and we all love each other very much. So it was a hard decision. They go, "We'll come back for you if we can." And they left me there. So I was able to find a rock that I was able to crawl kind of underneath and hold on. And luckily for me, my hands kind of froze in place. So even when the winds would whip me and lift my legs up, I was still attached to the rock. And I laid like that for almost half a day.
Oh,
and wow. My buddies actually were able to go, not build a proper snow cave because there's no snow up there. It's just blue ice. And they were using limited gear. But they actually were able to build a snow grave. And they came back to get me, which was just, they risked their lives to come back and save me. So I'm truly indebted to them.
Wow. So they leave you to go try and make some shelter with limited gear, and you're left kind of to your own devices. You find a rock. So the rock that you find is can you kind of describe that? Like, and then you said when your hands were in place, the wind was still blowing you, but that was the only thing kind of holding you down. Is that kind of,
yeah, the rock was like a turtle shell, like a big turtle shell. It was almost 6 feet long and probably, 13, 14 inches high.
Okay.
And it was just sticking out of the snow. So I was just had enough that I could kind of grip the bottom of it. And my hands froze kind of gripping. And it was enough for the wind to kind of blow over me like a windshield on a motorcycle. It just kind of gets it to go over top right. of you. But my legs were sticking out the one end. So when the winds would come, really strong ones, they would grab my legs and they would pick my legs up and throw me. And I'm thinking, if I let go of, if physically, if I have to hold on to the rock, I wouldn't be strong enough because you just lose strength.
Right.
But because my hands froze there, I didn't have to exert any energy. So it was actually a blessing.
Right. So what's going through your head at this point, like mentally, when you're there and this is happening to you? What are you thinking? How are you getting by, and how are you not, you know, just kind of saying screw it? And
well, it's funny. I read the stages of death, and there is certain stages, and I went through each one. You know, you barter with God, you know, if you allow me to live, I'll be a good person. And then there's anger, and then you go through them all, and then there's finally acceptance. So at near the end, I kind of accepted the fact I was going to die, and I was just kind of hoping it wasn't going to be painful. And I was also kind of hoping it would come quicker than it was, because I don't know if you've ever frozen your hands when you were a kid playing in rivers or playing soccer or something. It is painful. Mm-hmm. And that pain was moving up my arm. And then the ends of my fingertips started to go numb. So there was no pain. And as soon as I could feel that there was no pain there, I knew, well, that part of my body's dead now.
Right.
But it was just a long, long waiting thing. Like when my gloves got blown off, I could see my watch. Unfortunately, because I would not make a radio call, I could squeeze my elbows together and key my mic, and I would call every about half hour to see how they were doing with the snow cave. And so I'd say, okay, I'm not going to look at my watch for at least 10 minutes. So I'd wait what was, I thought, 10 or 15 minutes, and I'd look and it had been like 30 seconds.
Oh, man.
And it was just that slow.
Right.
And it seemed like it was never ending. It seemed like it lasted an eternity.
Right. And did you stay awake the whole time, or were you just kind of on alert, and like, what was your state of consciousness kind of there?
I guess the adrenaline kicking in kept me wide awake,
right?
Totally cognizant of what was going on.
Right.
It wasn't until we got into the snow grave that I warmed up a bit. I had the comfort of my friends, and then I started to go in and out of consciousness.
Right.
Alex was, he was comatose, and then Don, he was like me. He was in and out of consciousness too. So for the last day or two, we were all just walking zombies.
Right.
Like, all, it was funny. All three of us would talk, thinking that we were having a conversation, and we weren't. We were grunting.
Oh, jeez.
And nobody, we couldn't understand each other. I thought I was fine, and I knew they were very, very hypothermic. And they knew I was hypothermic, but they all thought they were fine.
Right.
It's so bizarre how you can't see it when it's affecting you.
Right. And did you guys have any, did you have any water or food, or did you just have kind of,
no.
I don't know if you, do you eat snow, or like, what do? You're just trying to survive, I guess.
And yeah, that was my job, was to melt some snow into water, and that got blown apart. So we had no water.
Mm.
You can't eat the snow because it'll burn more calories than it's worth, plus it lowers your body core temperature.
Oh, okay.
So we were just, and there was no food left. We'd actually come down from the top of the mountain. We were going from camp to camp, and all our food is in the camp below us.
Right.
So we had eaten everything we had the day before, and we're just going from one camp to the next. So we had no food, no water for almost 3 days.
Right. Okay. So you guys were caught in that subtropical cyclone for 2 or 3 days. What happens? How do you kind of take us through that?
We have line of sight radios, so we can talk to the group below us that are in a safe camp, and we let them know how much trouble we're in. But we can't talk to the group above us because they are around the rock bend on the other side of the mountain, and they have the satellite phone. So we know that we have to have a helicopter evacuation because we are unable to walk. We're unable to assist each other. We're patients by then.
Right.
So we can't let them know, the people with the satellite phone, to tell the outside world to get the rescue going. But we can tell the people below us, basically, this is, you know, what we're doing, and our calls were getting more and more kind of dire. By the end, we're saying, no, this is what we want you to tell our family. Right. This is our last wishes. Don wrote a letter to his wife, tucked it in his pocket. I gave directions to find a daughter I've never met. And it was a very, very somber, depressing kind of hours.
Mm-hmm.
And then as quick as the storm came, all of a sudden it was gone. Like when we saw the storm coming, we were on the ridge and it was about 400 miles away. So we figured a storm moves about 100 miles an hour. We got 4 hours till it hits. Camp's less than 2 hours away. We're going to rush, but we're not in a huge rush. We didn't think there was any problem. That storm hit within 15 minutes. It was just the most unusual storm I've ever seen. Like in my 30 years of climbing, I'd never seen anything like that. And I hope never to see it again. And as quick as it came, it was so loud. It was like a helicopter, like being right beside you where you couldn't even hear the guy right beside you. And then it was deathly quiet. And all of a sudden the sun came out and it was just gone.
Wow.
And we thought the storm had ended, but we were actually in the eye of it. So okay. We were just in a calm area.
Right.
And it was just, I remember it's just being so fantastic because the temperature raised probably 40 degrees in 15 minutes.
Oh man.
So it's like somebody hitting a sauna. It was like, and then we got up and we still couldn't talk. Don was the only one that was able to walk. And we just kind of sat on the lip of the grave. And luckily, Don was the most cognizant of all of us. So he was able to keep talking on the radio to the people below us. And then Alex was, I was just cradling him like a child on my lap mm-hmm. because he was out. And then when the storm broke, the people above us, they were in a safe camp too. When that broke, they just grabbed their gear and they started running down the mountain.
Right.
And when they came around the rock bend, they sent a mayday out to let everybody know that they were still alive because they thought everybody was worried about them because they were the highest on the mountain. And they had the satellite phone, and that's when they heard the news that how badly we were. So they got on the satellite phone and called for help.
Right. And then, so you guys are still there. Do you know this is happening? You don't know that they've called.
We know that they have the satellite phone and they've called for help.
Okay, so you guys know that. And then at what point do you, you know, think, okay, this is going to, you know, we're going to be okay. We're going to get off here anyways, at least, and hopefully live.
We were still so hypothermic, our brains aren't working properly. I knew that they had the satellite phone. They called for help. So I figured a helicopter is about 20 minutes away. And everything's going to be fine. We're too high for any helicopter. There is no helicopter 20 minutes away. The biggest town on the Canadian side is a population of about 800. They're not designed for high altitude rescues.
Right.
So when they did make the call with the sat phone, the first call they made was to the park rangers who couldn't help us.
Right.
Because they just don't have the gear or right. the training to do that kind of thing. So the next call was to 911. So you get a police officer and, you know, what are they going to do?
Yeah.
They drive their squad car up there. So the last call before the satellite phone died was to North Shore Rescue to talk to the then leader, Tim Jones.
Right, okay.
And Tim was doing a rescue on the Gros Grind for an American. And it was very strange, but there was a lot of American dignitaries were up here watching this search. And one was, you know, CIA, FBI, and a whole bunch of badges that I've never heard of. And they were just trying to make sure that this American that passed on the Gros Grind, that there was nothing strange about it, that it was just an accident, which it turned out it was. So Tim gets a call about 11:40 from the people that were above us, and it's a dire call. It was Eric, Don, and Alex are going to be dead. Nobody's going to help. We don't know what to do.
Right.
And Tim and I were good friends, but Alex and Tim were best friends. So Tim just finds out his best friend and two good friends are going to pass. So he's really shaken. So he tries to do a live broadcast at noon about this American that they're looking for. And about halfway through it, he breaks down and goes, I'm sorry, I can't do this right now. I got to go help some friends on Mount Logan. They're probably, or he didn't say they're probably going to pass on the news, but he was thinking that.
Right.
And that's how the world found out we were stuck, including our families. So now our families, everybody's phoning them wanting to know who's trapped, who's dead. And so he's got like 1,000 things on the go and he's still doing this search for the American because they haven't found him yet. And one of these Americans walked up to him and goes, you know, Mount McKinley, that's pretty close to Anchorage, isn't it? And he goes, yeah, it's about, I think, 350 miles east of Anchorage. And he goes, well, why don't you call the Alaskan Air Guard? And Tim goes, wow, yeah, do you know the number? And the guy goes, yeah, I do. So within 15 minutes of that conversation, we had the American military involved in our rescue. We don't know this. And just before they came, they phoned a high-altitude helicopter at Talkeetna, Alaska, that does all the rescues on Mount McKinley, and asked if he would assist. Mm-hmm. And he was one of those cowboy helicopter pilots that just, yeah, that sounds like fun.
Yeah.
Just grabbed his gear and started heading towards our way. And if that, the way it worked was perfect. Like you said, for us to get in that situation, everything that could go wrong went wrong for about 3 days.
Right.
For the rescue that happened afterwards, for about 6 hours, everything that could go right went right.
Nice.
And it was just lined up. We couldn't have planned it better.
Right.
Like if we had a year to plan it, we wouldn't have made it any better than what it was. And it was just fluke.
Right.
And they were able to get a basket up to us eventually and pick us off one at a time with a basket because they couldn't land and they couldn't take more than one person at a time because we're just so high. We're at 18,500 feet. It's the highest rescue ever done in Canada.
Right.
I think it may be one of the highest long lines in the world.
Right.
Probably in the top 10 anyway.
Yeah. Oh, well.
I haven't looked into that
18,000 feet, yeah, yeah. I would say. And so what's going through your mind? Because I remember reading in your book, too, something about that the helicopter came and then it went and then it came and it went. Like, is that true? Like, is that kind of what happened, too? Or so you guys are thinking, okay, yeah, we're good and then... What's he doing? He's not coming back, or is he coming back, or maybe he can't do it, or like what's going through your mind?
It was an emotional roller coaster.
Yeah.
Because our buddies wouldn't tell us that nobody was coming until they got to us.
Right.
Because they didn't want us to give up hope. So they didn't tell us anything. So we're waiting and looking for this helicopter that's never coming. Then they finally get to us and they finally break the news that we're on our own. We're going to try to do this together, but Eric, you're going to be left behind because, you know, two guys can't take care of three injured guys.
Right.
So they're going to go one to one. So they were going to leave me to die.
Oh,
again,
Jesus.
It's the only decision that could have been made. Just like when they left me to build a snow cave, it was the only decision and the right decision.
Right.
And then a helicopter shows up and leaves later, the military, because we're too high, it can't help us. And then another plane shows up and then they leave. Then another high altitude helicopter shows up and it leaves. And it was all, they were all trying to test the air and we're just too high. So we thought, oh, we're going to live. We're going to live. Here comes a helicopter. And then all of a sudden everybody leaves and no, we're screwed. So once eventually when they came and dropped a radio to us and we had direct, we could talk to them directly. The communication was one guy lightest. We're going to try a basket. And I thought, well, try and not the word I was really looking for.
Yeah.
And I was the worst injured. So that actually worked for my benefit. So I got to go first, plus being the heaviest. So I was kind of like the guinea pig.
Yeah.
And when the helicopter came, they threw me in the basket and tied me in. And I could hear the motor just revving. And it picked me up a couple inches and then dropped me, picked me up an inch and dropped me. And then I realized I'm too heavy. It can't lift me. And then next thing you know, he's dragging me sideways towards the cliff. And I'm wondering, does he know he's doing this? So I'm yelling at him. And of course, he can't hear me.
Right.
And he drops me a bit off this cliff. But I never knew they did this at altitude. The weight of me pulling the helicopter creates more pressure underneath the rotors. So it's something that they do at altitude, which I wish somebody had told me.
Yeah.
Because I thought he was going to drop me off the cliff, and if he couldn't hold me, he was going to hit the dynamite button, which lets go of the load. Me being the load, I'm thinking this is going to be a really long toboggan ride. But he was able to do it, went back, got my two other buddies, dropped us down about 10,000 feet where the military was waiting, and basically saved all of our lives.
Wow, that is... That's unbelievable. And then from there, are you the only one that goes to Alaska, to the hospital in Alaska, or you guys all went?
No, this shows what the kind of guys they are.
Yeah.
All three of us, next thing you know, we're in a Pave Hawk helicopter going up to Anchorage, Alaska, which happens to be the best frostbite hospital in the world.
Right.
So that's great news. But a lot of us were thinking, okay, we're in a military helicopter going to an American hospital, and none of us had bought special insurance.
Right.
But it turned out that we all had insurance because I'm covered through the fire hall with Blue Cross. So that was fantastic.
Right.
But all three of us went up to the hospital. Tim Jones chartered a plane, and him, another Bridget, another gal from the rescue team, and one of my friends from the fire hall flew up to be with me to help me. And that was very, very nice. And then the Don and Alex were released 2 days before I was. And they go, okay, you guys can go home. You're okay now. And they go, we're not going back to Vancouver without Eric. So they stuck around, waited for me, and we all flew back together.
Right.
So we left together and came back together. And I thought that was really
nice.
Yeah.
So when you're in the hospital in Anchorage, how long are you there? And what are they doing for you in Anchorage? And then where are they going to send you after that? Or where did they send you?
Well, they sent me back to VGH to the burn ward. But in Anchorage, they slowly rewarmed us. They used to put our hands a couple times a day into these whirlpools. And back when you were a kid and your hands got so cold, and then your parents would make you put them in warm water.
Yeah.
Imagine that times about 100.
Yeah, I can't. I can't even imagine that.
All the local firefighters dropped by to say hi, bring us beer. So we had beer piled up on one room. I think we probably had about 15, 20 cases time. The media just turned this into a frenzy. So the media were there every day, and I was high as a kite on painkillers. So I don't even remember half the interviews I did. Apparently some of them were pretty funny. Some of them were pretty insulting because I made jokes about going into fire prevention. I should have stayed on the mountain but it was a joke that would have been very, very funny at the fire hall, but insulting to any fire prevention officer that didn't get the context.
Wasn't the intention of that.
So looking back, I was thinking there's no way in the world I should have done any interviews in that condition.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, it makes total sense when you're, you've just been through a life or death experience. You're on pain meds. You're just trying to, figure out holy crap, I'm still alive. And then, you got interviews and all this stuff. So, I mean, that makes total sense.
And I was still trying to figure out how bad the injury was.
Right. Like
my hands were completely hard. Like I couldn't move any of my joints.
Right.
Except my thumb, one thumb. And I'm thinking, where does the injury stop?
Right.
And when I was on the mountain, it had frozen past my elbow. And I'm thinking, well, I wonder if, I'm going to get cut at the elbows. Mm-hmm. So when the freezing started coming back down my arm, I was thinking, oh, this is fantastic. Maybe I'll just lose my fingernails because that happens quite a bit. And no, it was a little worse than that. But in the grand scheme of things, I'm very, very excited, very, very happy with how much I was able to keep because I was able to retest and go back to my job as a firefighter, even though I'm missing, nine tips of nine digits.
Right.
And I can still basically do everything I did before. Like I still have a hard time with intricate things, and socially it's very awkward, but for the most part, it's a nuisance. That's it. Which when you think it could have been death, that's not bad.
Right. And you are definitely making the most of, a situation that, wasn't the greatest situation that you really didn't cause, or it just kind of happened, and now you're making the best of it. So, for that, I commend you for that. That's, amazing, shows amazing resilience in a situation where you don't know what's going to happen, and to come out of it with that attitude of, screw this. They're not going to tell me that I can't do this or that, especially with the fire department. So maybe, if you want to talk a little bit about how long you were, off, and then what you were doing during that time, and then the process of the stuff that is, even more interesting is how you got your job kind of back, I think that's amazing.
Well, the doctors gave me a timeline, and they said I'd basically be off for about 2 years before I was self-sufficient, and that would mean just taking care of myself. And I didn't really like that answer, so I took it upon myself to speed up the healing process. So they would tell me stuff like, I'd go to rehab and they would have me drag my fingers across sand. And my fingers, when they amputated them, it was like broken bones sticking out the end. So it was extremely sensitive. And they go, so every about 10 or 15 minutes, drag your hand across once. And I go, yeah, that would take about 2 years then to get back to the where I was. So I would sit at home and I would dig both hands in uncooked rice till the blood and the pus was just flowing and tears were coming down. And I hardened my fingers up in a couple weeks instead of months.
Oh, wow.
And I was only actually off the job 8 months from the day that I got rescued off Mount Logan to the day I was back as a full-time firefighter, which I thought was absolutely incredible. I didn't expect a parade or anything. And then I got suspended for 9 months because they said I didn't fill out some paperwork. Oh. And I'm thinking, my God, after what I've been through, and it turns out I did do the paperwork right. I was heading off to climb Mount Elbrus in Russia, and my fire chief said, I don't think you should go climb. We've invested a lot of money in you. And I said, well, I don't think you should tell me what to do on my days off. And it went downhill from there, and they said I didn't fill out the paperwork for my holidays. So they suspended my privileges, which meant at the time I was single parent, so it really impacted on how I could see my children.
Yeah.
And I'm looking at this guy going, you're a fucking idiot.
Yeah.
And I just couldn't understand how they could do this, because all I was doing was trying to feel normal again. Like, I fought and won my job back as a firefighter. I knew they didn't want me there. They made it as difficult as possible.
Right.
The union was kind of indifferent. The brotherhood, for whatever reason, had dried up when I got injured. And I'm thinking, this is a one-man battle.
Right.
And now I'm facing these overwhelming odds, and you're piling new stuff on me.
Right.
And so I went and I climbed Elbrus, summited. And I remember sitting there on the summit with a big smile thinking, I showed that dick.
How long after, so this May 2005 is the climb of Logan.
Yeah.
How long after that are you climbing in Russia?
Canada Day the next year, so 13 months later, I was standing on the summit of Mount Elbrus, which is the highest mountain in Europe, in Russia.
Nice.
And just having a great time, especially knowing that all these dorks back at the fire hall were stewing about me doing it again.
Right.
And for the first time in a long time, I felt good. I felt strong. And it gave me the courage to keep carrying on.
Right.
To keep trying.
Yeah.
Not to listen to all the naysayers.
And it just reminds me of a quote. I wrote down a couple of quotes here from your book. And, you know, that makes total sense to what you're saying there. You say in your book, I felt most at home when I was in the mountains. And for me, mountaineering was one of the major things that defined me as a person. So when you say that about being on top of the mountain and feeling those things, I mean, that just makes total sense.
Well, everybody has their happy place. Like, some people it's working out. Some people it's riding their bicycle.
Yeah.
Like, for my club, it's riding our motorcycles.
Right.
Because now I don't climb as much as I used to. But you have to have that happy place. And for somebody to tell you, no, you can't do that anymore, right, who's going to listen?
Right. Yeah. And I mean, that makes total sense. I can understand a lot of that because, you know, and I didn't mention this before, but where we met at the resiliency program, I mean, we learned a lot about that kind of stuff. And, so yeah, I totally understand that, but, we're here to talk about you and your experience. So we won't, we don't need to talk about that. So have you done any other climbs?
Oh, yeah, I did Mount Everest in 2009.
Right.
And I climbed up to about 28,000 feet. I got just below the Hillary Step, and I got a little bit of high-altitude cerebral edema. So my brain was starting to shut down. So I turned around, and it was just a fantastic climb. Had a great time. Then I did Mount Aconcagua, I think two years ago. And that's when I realized that my climbing days were over. Mm. Like, I'm at the point now, I'd rather go to the beach and have room service and a sit-down toilet. On Aconcagua, I just don't enjoy it. It's not my happy place. So I've moved on. You know, I like riding the Harleys with my buddies. I like traveling, just not the extreme climbing anymore.
Right. Cool, man. It's just such an amazing story. And, you know, we'll talk a little bit about the book at the end, but, so you went back to firefighting. They made it difficult for you. They put you through a bunch of, you know, tests and maybe some made up tests. And I don't know exactly what that was all about, but,
well, one of the tests they had me do, and I was an officer at the time, is I had to cut a hole in metal with a partner saw above my head.
Mm-hmm.
And I've never had seen a firefighter have to do that in real life. And I've never seen any firefighter being told he has to do that to be able to keep his job.
Right.
And it was at the same time, another firefighter was being transferred from dispatch onto the fire floor. And I looked at the tests that person had to do, which were extremely minimal for someone to become a firefighter to start,
right,
compared to my, you know, I think I went through 5 days of training or 5 days of testing where I've said, if I fail any one of them that I couldn't come back.
Right.
And I was looking at this other person thinking, well, they couldn't do that test. And I thought, well, how fair is this if a returning officer is held to such a high standard compared to a junior firefighter?
Right. Because at that point too, you'd been on, what, 16 years or something like that. So
yeah, I was an officer too.
Right.
And so, like you say, how many officers do you see running around with a partner saw?
Right. Yeah.
But it was a personality conflict between me and the chief, who I, you know, to this day can't stand.
Right.
It was funny. He retired, wanted to shake my hand. I just looked at him and kind of laughed.
Yeah. And you know what? You know, hopefully, you know, he's not doing what he's doing now. So hopefully that part of the job has moved on. And it sounds like, you know, you're getting close to where you've been 29 years now, over 29. And so you're getting close to.
Oh, yeah, I'll pull the pin soon.
Yeah.
I've had a great career. Yeah. I've enjoyed it, and absolutely, I'm ready to move on to the next chapter and let some young person start their great career.
Yeah. And the next chapter too is, you know, some of the things that you're doing now to, you know, help other firefighters, inspire people, anything, you know, like that. Maybe explain a little bit about, motorcycle club, the Florian Knights. It's that's where we're, like we said earlier, we're in the clubhouse right now, which is really freaking awesome. I can probably see myself coming here again one day, but I don't have a motorcycle, but
don't have to.
Yeah.
No, basically at the fire hall, like I said, when my injury happened, the brotherhood just dissipated. I was one of those people that really, really had a strong desire to be part of the brotherhood. So I met the Florian Knights when I started to get involved with PTSD. I knew I was suffering with it. There was nothing in place at my fire hall. And I asked a couple people and nobody could help me. So I started to do my own research. So I started to get involved with the resiliency program. And I heard about this motorcycle club that was doing a fundraiser. And they asked me if I'd come give a talk at it. So I went and I met the president, Nick Elms. And he told me about the Florian Knights. And basically what it is, it's a group of firefighters that hang out, fundraise for the BC Professional Firefighters Burn Fund, the Kids Camp for Burn Survivors, and the Resiliency Program, and a place for people to come to discuss PTSD. And I thought, this sounds perfect. And I have a Harley. And I joined that night, basically told them it was something I really, really was interested in. So we got a clubhouse in Burnaby. Any firefighter is welcome to come. They hang out. We have extra rooms here if you want to have a couple beer, so nobody can drink and drive, and you know, get involved. And if you like riding, especially if you like riding, come meet us and start hanging out with us. And any firefighter is welcome to join. There's only a couple things. You have to have a union built bike, and you can't be a douchebag.
And how do they? How does someone find you guys? Are you guys? Do you have a website or online or?
Yeah, we have floriansknights.com. So FLORINS knights KNIGHTS.com. And yeah, just come by. Just, it's a great place to be because every single guy here has dealt with or will deal with PTSD.
Right.
So it's a great place to just sit around and talk to people that have the same issues you do.
Right. And I mean, it sounds like a something that is needed, you know, something that there's nothing else like it out there, and a safe place for guys to just, you know, have some support. And it's, you know, because like you said, a lot of times, you know, at the fire hall, and it, whether it's lack of awareness or people don't know what to do or they're scared, they feel the same way themselves. There's not that support maybe, you know, for you at work or if you're off work. And, you know, it's sounds like a great place to be, to come and be safe. And, you know, you guys are doing great things. It's the money that you guys raise, you know, for the different charities is unbelievable. So,
and like I said, like my accident was May 2005, and I really suffered when I felt abandoned by the Brotherhood. So say 2006, and I looked, it wasn't until I found the Knights, and that was like 12 years later, that I actually had a Brotherhood where I could discuss and get the help that I needed.
Right.
And it's a great bunch of guys, and we're always looking for new people to come hang out.
Right. Well, hopefully there's a couple firefighters listening to us talk, and there is, I know there is. And, just cause we've had a few downloads of the previous podcast, but, we'll get the word out. And, yeah, I think that's a great, you know, a great thing that you guys are doing in light of what has happened and trying to make the most out of, you know, a shitty situation.
Oh, definitely.
You know, for lots of people, because there's lots of people out there suffering. And like you said, most people, if you're doing the job of a firefighter, you are at some point in your career, you're going to, you know, be suffering a little bit. So to at least have one more resource that's, you know, that's a safe place is amazing.
Every little bit helps. We are a very stoic group of people, but how can you see a dead child and not be negatively affected? Like, right. It's just not possible.
Right.
How can you see and do the things that we do on a regular basis and not have an outlet to talk to other people and know that you're not alone and know that there is help out there?
Right.
And that's why I joined the Knights, because now I have a group of people that I can do that with.
Right. And you were saying too, and where we met for the first time was at the Firefighter Resiliency Program put on by the BC Professional Firefighters. And initially there was some help from Wounded Warriors of Canada, but I heard that they backed out now from that program. So, but there still seems to be some support for it. And now you are actually giving your time back to the program as a camp champion or leader, or I'm not sure what they call it, but
I volunteer my time as a team lead.
Right.
So at every program, there's two team leads that come with the eight people, and all we're there to do is answer questions from the other firefighters that may feel more comfortable asking us than they would the psychologists. And we're just there to kind of open up the area to talk. Like, mm-hmm. If nobody wants to talk, I'll tell my story. Once they've heard my story, you know, they'll see that their own story is very similar, and then they're more apt to tell their story.
Yeah.
So we just basically are there to assist.
Yeah, that's amazing. I know that that program has helped a lot of people. It's in its infancy right now, but sounds like, you know, they've got maybe about three or four more this year, and then it sounds like maybe up to 10 already pre-booked for next year. So
it's probably the best 4 days I've ever spent as a firefighter. And some of the comments afterwards, and I've had guys say to me, like, you know, I was going to commit suicide last week, mm-hmm. and now I got a new hope. Thank right. you so much. So, like, I think every firefighter in the world, like, we do this job to help. So when somebody tells you you help save their lives, it makes you feel pretty good.
Yeah.
And that's how powerful this program is. So I think any firefighter out there suffering, or even if they're not, like, it is a great program for the younger guys to get the tools before they actually need them.
Right. Well, prevention, you mean?
Yeah.
Wow, what an amazing concept.
Yeah.
Anyways, we don't have to get into that right now, but I think we're both in agreement there. So that is, you know, I think your story is very, inspiring. I loved reading your book. That being said, is there anything, just to kind of close out, I'm going to ask you a few questions, but is there any books that you would recommend people read or, you know?
Besides mine?
No, not besides yours at all. Absolutely. Because your book to me is inspirational because it goes through what happened, a grave situation, how you dealt with it, how you overcame the obstacles, and how you've been resilient, and how now you're giving back to other people and still trying to help people even after the stuff that has happened to you. So definitely you can recommend your book, but I'll let you talk about it.
Well, my book's called Surviving Logan. You can order it online or in any bookstore will pull it in. I think one of the books that helped me out quite a bit was The Art of Happiness by the Dalai Lama.
Yeah.
For whatever reason, it really resonated with me. That's probably, I don't read a lot.
Yeah, either, no, that's fine. Two. I wanted to give you a little plug for your book
perfect,
there.
Perfect, yeah.
And where can they find your book, Surviving Logan?
Any bookstore will carry it or order it in, or the easiest is Amazon.
Right.
And then it's delivered.
Cool. Yeah. And I have to say too, I've read the book. I skimmed it over again today just because some of this, there's so much information in there, but I would recommend that, 100% to anyone who just wants to, see a story about resilience and how you can overcome obstacles. And yeah, just, is there anything that you would, any advice that you, anything you've learned like from this, or any advice that you would maybe give someone who's maybe listening to this and, just something they might want to hear or something you've learned or,
I think the most powerful lesson I learned on Logan, when I was sitting there and I thought I was dying, I looked back at my life and I was kind of smiling because I've lived and I've gone and pursued every dream I've ever had, no matter how stupid it was. So I think that is something I'd like to pass on. Like, no matter what the dream is, just go do it.
Right.
Don't listen to the naysayers. Don't listen to all the people that say it's dumb or you can't be done. If you have something that you want to do, if you want to go live in the Amazon, go live in the Amazon.
Yeah.
Don't listen to these people that say, well, that's stupid. There'll be bugs there. Just enjoy life.
Right.
Because we only get one shot at this, so we might as well have as much fun as we can.
Right.
And I think one of the things that I heard somebody say too is one of the counselors that did a lot of work with the people that were dying.
Yeah.
And he asked them what their regrets were in life. And he said it was an overwhelming response was it was never what they did. It was what they didn't do that they regretted. Right. And so that's what I think. Just go do everything you want.
Yeah. No,
within reason.
Right.
And
no,
safety.
That's great advice. I mean, it just makes, it's hard, I think, sometimes for people to believe that, like to hear that and conceptually think of, oh, well, I'm just going to do whatever I want. But really, I mean, to live the life that you want and live it for yourself, that's, amazing advice. And it's kind of like what you're saying, no regrets, right? Like, you seem to have done the things you wanted to do, regardless of the outside influences. If people tell you can't do it, that it's almost like you just got motivated more by, doing that. And, another thing I feel from talking to you too is it's not about what you can't do. It's about what you can do with what you have.
Exactly.
And I think that's a big one. That's definitely what I took away from talking to you, because, it is what it is. And you can either let it, sink you, or, you can you can swim away and do the best with what you have. And so I think, you know, your advice is amazing. And I think your story's amazing. You're a cool dude. The Florian Knights seem pretty awesome. I'm glad there's not a bunch of guys in here and with vests on and
like
helmets. Yeah, I know. I know a couple of them, but I'm not, you know, I'm not a biker yet or, you know, but I'm definitely coming back here. And I appreciate you taking the time out of your day to talk to me and, you know, maybe hopefully help some other firefighters. And, it was really great seeing you, man. And really great talking to you. So for that, I appreciate it. I love what you're doing. You're truly inspirational. You know, the bond that we created as a group at that resiliency program, you know, just kind of carries over. And it's kind of like family that you don't talk to all the time, but you just know you can call each other or, you know, it's like you have never left when you start talking again. It's like, oh yeah. Okay. Yeah. Hey buddy, how you doing? So anyways, I want to you know, say that I appreciate our relationship and thank you so much for doing this and telling your story. I know it's probably, you know, not super easy to tell it. So for that, I appreciate it.
And no, I find it cathartic.
Yeah. Well, it's good. All right, buddy. Well, thank you again. And there you have it.
Anytime.
All right. Man, that was awesome. What a great conversation with Eric. He's a great dude. He is someone who just wants to help people. And he will just keep doing that forever. He's changed a little bit as, you know, he's gotten a bit older as far as wanting to mountaineer anymore. And like he said, he wants to spend more time on the beach and in the sun, which I can 100% relate to because I am a beach bum at heart. And if you want to contact Eric, you can contact him through the Florian's Knights at floriansknights.ca or email at info@floriansknights.ca. Go grab his book and read it. There's so much more to so much more detail as to what happened up on that mountain. It will blow your mind. So go buy his book. His book is Surviving Logan. It's available on all the regular spots where you would buy books. And probably the easiest is Amazon. So hopefully you enjoyed this. It's a bit shorter than episode 2. But we got right down to it, got right to the point. And yeah, I hope you enjoyed it. And I hope, you know, if you do need help, if you are struggling with mental health issues, please reach out. You can reach out to me. You can reach out on Instagram. Send me a message. Beyond the Big Red Truck. Facebook under me, Brad Robinson, or Beyond the Big Red Truck page on Messenger. Just please know that you are not alone. And I hope that I hear from you. Please leave comments. I'd love to hear your feedback on what you think of the podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. I just want to help make a difference and I want the world to be a better place because I was here. So thanks for listening. I'm truly grateful. Love you guys. I'm Brad and this is Beyond the Big Red Truck Podcast.